Hey, welcome to roughly 30 seconds of Not the Lush podcast. But don't worry, it's coming in a sec. I'm just here to let you know about another podcast made by Lush because let's face it, you have great taste in podcasts. And I reckon you'll like some other stuff we do, such as Tiny Revolutions, a show hosted by Tiff Stevenson where she chats with other comedians about whether comedy can be a force for social change. You know the drill here. You can find it where you find your podcasts. And I'm assuming you know how to find podcasts because how else would you have ended up here? Clever clogs. Oh, also, check out the free Lush Player app, please. Thank you. Bye.
Hello and welcome to the Lush Podcast. I'm your host, Nilla Davies, and I'm joined by my amazing, wonderful, talented, gifted, inspirational co-host, Miss Olivia Graham. Whoop, whoop. In today's episode, we are talking about wildlife. Clips in today's episode include Elise McKenna in conversation with Bruce Parry about the war on wildlife at Seed Festival. The next two clips are from the Lush Summit 2018. And the final clip is Maya Rose Craig in conversation with Charlie Murs about her passion for birding. Enjoy! So the reason we're talking about wildlife is, I don't know if you've heard about the sort of campaign we as Lush are working on at the minute, the war on wildlife. And we have a podcast coming out soon about specifically the war on wildlife and what that means. So we've been working loads in collaboration with the legend that is Chris Packham, who is a TV presenter, but he's done a lot for the rights of animals and the welfare of wildlife.
Birds in particular,
loves a wee bird. Basically, last September, we launched a campaign where people could come in to shops and sign postcards to try and basically get people involved in the acknowledging what's going on with wildlife in Britain at the minute. Mm-hmm. And then last September was the People's Walk for Wildlife in London, so a load of Lush ones went down. We were involved in that. And basically, the signing of the treaty, along with the Manifesto for Wildlife, which is a magazine, so it's a collection of different writings about the decline of wildlife and to inspire people and inform people. It's like, what can we do? So we've been working closely with him. And from that now, the legend that is also Charlie Murs, he is now creating this podcast, which launches on the 12th of August. So basically, what we as a company at the minute are trying to do is inform people about the decline in wildlife and inspire people and help people learn stuff. So that's what we're going to do today. We're going to talk about wildlife.
Got ya. All makes complete sense.
See,
I feel very safe.
It all comes full circle. You feel safe. I feel safe. It's a beautiful time.
I feel like, you know, when you're at Alton Towers and you get like the best safety
harness,
and it goes over and then it clicks in as well.
Yeah, that's me. So first of all, I'm going to ask you a real serious question.
No.
I am. Do you believe that there is a war on wildlife in the UK?
What, like people are at war with animals? Mm-hmm.
Like when we say wildlife, I, in my head, wildlife means all sort of natural areas. So that's inclusive of like space and land and reserves and animals.
I think there's like a byproduct war. Yes.
Yeah. So you think, I think that the actions of humans creates a war on wildlife that we're probably not even aware that we're doing, which is kind of scary.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not a great time. Like at the minute.
Well, yeah, there just is, isn't there? There's just less.
At the minute, there's a huge list of threatened species. So the ICN have a website you can go onto and you can read about like what animals in the UK are like now like threatened or have the chance of becoming endangered. Like simple like things like, well, not simple things, but things that you take every day for granted, like butterflies, hedgehogs, bees, insects, you know, they're all in rapid decline, and it's because of, I think, mainly pollution and contamination and the lack of respect for the wildlife areas that we do have. So it's a case of we're just not being mindful or compassionate.
So also just like what's a big part of it, like road extensions?
Yeah, road extensions, like in the degradation of we talked about verges before. So our first clip today is Elise McKenna catching up with Bruce Parry.
Whoa, Elise!
Whoop, whoop. Bruce Parry, have you heard of him before?
No.
Who is he? Former Royal Marines commando officer, environmental reporter.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm.
And Elise caught up with him at Seed Festival a while ago.
Oh, fantastic.
And she asked him, as I just asked you, if he thought there was a war on wildlife.
I bet his answer. It's probably not doesn't get as good as answer as me.
Here we go.
Go on.
So do I believe there's a war on wildlife? Well, not really. I mean, I think that war's a strong word. I mean, I definitely think that our farming practices can be very focused just on the things that are being farmed and not in biodiversity, and therefore lots of stuff is culled accordingly. And so there's a bit of a war there for things that aren't necessarily but seen as pests or vermin. That definitely seems to be a war. The rest of us, we're not actively at war. I mean, we're incidentally causing a lot of harm. It might not be aware or overt, but it's definitely the way we're living is causing, let's say, you know, this like sixth mass extinction and huge biodiversity loss. So there seems to be some sort of like terrible extermination happening, but I don't know that it's necessarily something that we would do if we realized. So it doesn't feel like a war in a conscious way, but it definitely feels like the effects are warlike. So what would we do to combat it if there is this war going on? Well, clearly becoming aware of it is the first step, and then just becoming more conscious of it and therefore reevaluating our behavior would help. I think that clearly the separation and seeing ourselves as separate from nature is a massive problem, and it's been around for a long time. And it's probably born out of since the earliest days of agriculture 10,000 years ago, where we started manipulating and domesticating and seeing ourselves as the lords and masters. I've had the great privilege of living with people who understand implicitly that that's madness, because the well-being of the natural world is directly related to the well-being of ourselves. But we've somehow lost that. It was easier, I guess, for the hunter-gatherers, because they could see instantly that their actions on nature had an equal and opposite reaction on themselves. But we've sort of, with our technology and our great prowess, have managed to sort of export all of the detritus and the problems over the hill. And so we can carry on living in our seemingly beautiful lives while we're causing craters and slag piles and poisons elsewhere. But of course, there's so many of us now that all those problems are coming home to roost, and we're slowly beginning to wake up to the fact that we are in one living ecosystem, one bubble, one spaceship Earth, and that all of these problems are indeed going to cause us all problems in the long run. Climate change being an obvious example, and the poisoning of the seas and the destruction of the forests and all the rest of it. But we're on such a fast conveyor belt, like a train steaming towards cataclysm, that we're waking up to it at a very difficult time, because we're all very comfortable on this nice little train, and so getting off it feels very, very hard indeed. But getting off it's what's needed. So what do we do? Well, we first have to wake up and accept the reality. We have to then also be motivated to change, because, or to get off the train, because if we don't, it's not going to be good. And we have to feel more deeply. I think that's the other thing. It's all very well intellectualizing this, but until we actually feel in ourselves this connection, the connection to nature, the empathy for nature, the realization that our actions in the world are also actions on ourselves. If we don't feel it, then we're much less motivated to change. We've actually got to feel it. But the difficulty with feeling it is that we have to open ourselves to feelings. And in many ways, we're kind of relatively, I believe, living in a sort of anesthetized state, where we have dulled our senses, because for a number of reasons. Firstly, really waking up to the feeling of what our actions are doing in the world is very painful. But secondly, we're all carrying so much trauma. I think just being in many of the civilized societies of today, we're carrying a lot of pain deep down inside, and to open ourselves up to feeling means opening ourselves up to all of our own inner troubles, and that's clearly very hard. So I also think on top of that, you're talking a lot here, but you did ask me a complex question. On top of that, I think believing that going on the journey of looking at ourselves, doing our healing and feeling more deeply is a good journey to go on is essential too. We have to believe that learning to feel more deeply, learning to go on the inner journey, learning to heal and undo all of our stuff so that we can reconnect with the feelings that we need so much. We need to believe that that's something worth doing. And that's obviously very difficult for a lot of people, because a lot of people, it's easier to just be in denial. It's easier to be nihilistic or fatalistic and go, well, there's nothing I can do. And therefore avoid going into that difficult place inside ourselves. But if we can truly believe that going on the healing journey is a good thing to do, and it will bring positive results in the long run, even if it's difficult in the short run, if we can believe that that's worth doing, then there's a chance that we might actually do it. But at the moment, there's a competition of beliefs, a competition of narratives, and a competition of all sorts out there that are persuading us and telling us not to bother. Mm. And that is dangerous, because we have to learn how to feel. So there you have it. In not very much of a nutshell, what we need to do is we need to learn how to feel, we need to learn how to reconnect, and we need to get off the train and shift our lives in the knowledge that we will all be better in the long run, and then we have a chance.
Well, Bruce, I feel... Well, first of all, such deep, much emotions.
Yeah, that got real deep.
Yeah.
And we also didn't really hear Elise's voice, which I'll tell you, I was disappointed.
Oh,
that would have moved me.
I agree with them. I think it is about mindfulness. And I think when it comes to our planet, I don't think we're mindful at all.
No.
I think the developments that we've had socially and industrially, I think we've made those advancements considering ourselves.
Well, yeah. And this is, I know I always talk about sleep, but I'm now like really in the depth of the Why We Sleep book.
Okay.
I told you about it before.
You did tell me about it before.
So it's this fella who, it's this fella, I've totally forgotten his name because I'm sleep deprived, so give me a break. But he just talks about all the science of sleep, essentially. It's in like a couple of sections. And one of the sections is like why we don't sleep. And one of the main reasons is like the stimulus from light, because we're used to like the sun coming up and the sun going down. So part of that stimulus is also temperature. So as the sun goes down, the temperature drops and your body like prepares for sleep. But because of like heating and duvets and, you know, insulation, your house doesn't necessarily cool down the way you're like, you've evolved to get colder, mm-hmm. to relax into sleep. And that's why I remember on a previous podcast, had you listened, the idea of like getting a bath is because it pushes all the heat out of your body. Mm-hmm. And so you're like naturally cooling down. Anyway, so one of the things is blue light on the phones,
yep.
which science, and this is actual science, like I actually know it, it's science, is the invention of the blue light on phones is what is keeping us like highly stimulated, mm-hmm. and unable to sleep. It's like a big part of it. And the reason that we're so highly stimulated by blue light is because we're evolved from fish. So if you believe in evolution, we're evolved from fish. And blue is the strongest light that carries through water. So that's why if you open your eyes on the water, like everything looks blue. It's because it's the strongest light that can travel. So it's the most stimulating. And so inventing blue lights on phones
is to get you addicted.
Well, yeah, but it's also just been really detrimental, even though it was like this huge scientific breakthrough or like technical breakthrough. It's really detrimental to human beings and people who have sleeping problems.
Mm. Yeah, and it's... Well, becoming conscious and reevaluating those things as well. Like, I'm not going to lie, I generally day to day don't really interact with any wildlife.
I thought you were going to say with anyone, sorry.
No, with any wildlife. If I'm in a city, the most is walking through a park. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, my existence is probably integral to it in some ways. Like pollination, all that kind of jazz.
Yeah, and I have a park, you know, the park by mine, yeah. Princess Park. There were swans in there, and they had, it's a dead sad story,
oh.
they had babies, seven of them, and they kept depleting in numbers. And basically because last summer was so, so hot, the pond water went really low, so the swans had access to like maggots that were on the bottom of the pond, and it killed them. Isn't that? And that is like real life global. You think that global warming's not a thing, but
people
that...
don't think it affects them in their day to day, like, but it definitely 100% does. Well, on that note, I have clubbed together some things you can do.
Oh, great!
To support your local wildlife. I did some, didn't do some research. This was all in my brain because I know everything.
Yeah.
Things you can do to support your local wildlife. One, fundraise.
Oh.
Walks, runs, bake sales, etc. Give your money to local charities taking action to conserve and protect wildlife in your area. Start small, start around you, and work out bigger.
Fantastic.
Make a couple of cherry bakewells and sell them for a fiver.
Can you make a cherry bakewell?
Yes,
could only be bought.
There's only one human and his name is Mr. Kipling that can provide cherry bakewells. No, Olivia, you can make them.
Okay.
Campaign, lobby, be present, be informed. So go to like local group discussions or like, because a lot of people just volunteer in their local area to help look after the wildlife there. So ask those people, you know, go with them and go to talks and things that they go to and just learn stuff. Like I've been very lucky that I know a lot of amazing, all of my friends are really good at gardening. So they've tried to teach me little things here and there that can help like the biodiversity in your garden at home. Volunteer, litter picks. Get the rubbish off the beaches, that kind of thing. Well, and also just the streets, because that's gross. And then, well, for wildlife gardening, it's kind of the similar to learning stuff from other people. But planting plants that are good for biodiversity is amazing, and encouraging all the insect lads into your garden.
Lads? Did you just call the insects lads?
Just the insect lads.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Is that not...
Well, do you know any plants that are good for diversity? Sorry.
Like
to make Nuala frown.
No, so I was stayed with my friend last week in Poole, and she has a gardener that lives near her who is taking all the little communal areas of grass around their houses and like planting wildflowers and like throwing seed bombs so that loads of different types of plant grow and different types of flower grow to encourage lots of different insects to that area. So then they get it on.
That's good.
Let's get it on. It's called rewilding.
Fantastic.
And you can do that anywhere. So if you live in a block of flats, you've got a wee bit of grass outside, club together, buy some seeds, throw them down at you.
I actually have an example of this in Liverpool, best city in the world. So do you know about, well, there's an area in Liverpool in Toxteth that was massively underfunded and they were moving people out into different areas and the residents there to like... say that they were still happy to live there and they still had this community, were planting planters in the area and then kept basically using gardening as a way to like say we're still here and we still respect our streets. And then Assemble from London got involved and did like Granby 4 Streets as an art project, and then they won the Turner Prize. And now they've got like a trust in the area where they've bought two houses and turned them into a winter, it's called the Winter Garden. It's like an indoor, like it's literally an indoor greenhouse with one bedroom, but it's like it's like all open completely to the ceiling with like a glass roof. It's absolutely gorgeous.
Amazing. Yeah, there's, I don't know if you've ever heard of the Med Project Garden in London.
Oh yeah.
Ian Solomon Kowal runs it and you can go there and like he grows, like he teaches people in that area how to grow like certain vegetables in their gardens, stuff like that, which encourages like the use of the space, but also then people to understand more about like the wildlife in their area and what they need for that specific area to encourage it. Visit wildlife areas, so like go in and visit in like forests and parks and give in that wee donation and for the people that help look after the space, just encourage it to stay there and be there, because I think more often than not councils get like they just get rid of space because they don't think it's important to the area. But if you're going and you're visiting and you're making use of it and respecting it and loving it and giving it the money to preserve and keep it up, then that's a good thing too. So that's my tips and tricks.
All sound great. And they all sound like kind of nice things to do.
Yeah, like I don't think...
Kind of nice things. Kind of. They all sound really nice.
I don't think any of them are particularly difficult or asking a lot of people. You know, they're small things, you can do it. But if we all did one or two small things, that adds up. So the next clip... is some clips from panels from the Lush Showcase last year, and their discussions about the war on wildlife, a couple of different panels that Charlie Moores hosted. So I thought we'd listen to that.
Oh yeah, God.
So here's clip one, and it's sort of about love and loving wildlife and why we have to do that.
You know, as stewards of our own land, and our own land could be a windowsill, a doorstep, you know, a little front garden, a back garden, you know, like your child's school playground. We as individuals have the power to make those changes and to improve those habitats for wildlife. And that could be anything from just putting a dish of water out for birds to planting up a pot of lavender, to digging a pond, to cutting holes in your fence on either side so hedgehogs can pass through. There are so many millions of things that we can do and actually take responsibility for ourselves. And come back to what Bella and Hugh were saying about love. It is love. It's absolutely 100% love, and love is infectious. And the more we talk about how we love this, and the more we enthuse about it, and just the more we do to our front gardens, actually, you know, the Jones effects, keeping up with the Joneses, you know, it's infectious. People will follow. People will come on board, and it makes you feel better. It makes you happier having birds come into your garden, having hedgehogs come in, you know, and just seeing these things, just getting up in the morning and just, you know, seeing wildlife outside your window.
Yeah.
It makes you happy and it lifts you. And so, yeah, it's a fantastic opportunity, and I thank Chris for giving me the opportunity to talk about this to a much wider audience, because I've been banging on about this for years.
Just before, you touched on solutions there, and I'd like to talk to everybody about what the solutions are, because we are in crisis.
Yeah.
Part of it is going to say, actually, let's admit we really love these things. We really need these things.
Yeah.
It's good for our mental health. It's beyond what's good for our health.
Yeah.
We should be thinking about what's good for the health of everything that lives out there as well.
And I had, well, I was interviewed by Sky News yesterday, and I've been laughing over the video of it this morning, because the interviewer asked me, what do hedgehogs do for us? You know, as if to say, well, we, you know, they don't have any purpose. They don't, you know, they don't deserve to be saved because they don't have any sort of monetary value. You know, you can put a price on bees because of their pollination services, but, you know, we haven't yet learned how to train hedgehogs to shine our shoes, and therefore, you know, we can't save them. And I pulled this very expressive face, which suggested what I was thinking of him at the time, and just said, like, it's about love, and they make us feel better, and it is, it's about mental health, and it's about just feeling a bit better. It's about mindfulness as well. It's, you know, it's about the little lifts, the little daily lifts that wildlife bring us. And
yeah, absolutely.
They make us happy.
That was lovely.
Yeah, well, it is about love. It's about appreciating what's there and just giving it a little bit of time and care, you know? Yeah, and seeing, like, how wildlife, like, think how much poetry and art is inspired by wildlife and the, you know, nature around us.
I suppose it is important what she said about that some humans don't care about certain animals because they don't do something for them.
Yeah.
And then if you translate that to, like, humans not caring for other humans that they can't, like, monetize, then
yeah,
that's just capitalism, isn't it?
Exactly. And I mean, it, like, it's everyone's responsibility. That's the scary thing. Like, there's no one that it won't affect.
Yeah.
Which is mad. We have another clip from the showcase that we're going to listen to as well. And it's sort of like a beautiful poetic summary of why we have to care about the war on wildlife.
There is a fantastic quote from Stephen Jay Gould, which I've used in a lot of my writing. And he said, "We will not fight to save what we do not love." And I think there's absolutely critical at the moment, one of the really critical moments we've got, is that we are being lured into liking stuff. Everything we do, we like it. We like it on social media. We tick a box, we like it. And that's half-hearted. And we need a wholehearted commitment. And that was what was so great about yesterday, was it was wholehearted. It wasn't half-hearted. It was an absolute commitment. It was pouring with rain. We did not shirk that. It was absolutely wholehearted. And it's because it's born out of love. And we have become squeamish about that. We've become detached from that feeling of, you know, we can't be expressing ourselves so completely openly. I think we need to. We need to reclaim love. We need to reclaim a love of nature. And then we will fight for it. You do not begin a revolution because you like something.
Yeah.
You begin a revolution only out of love. And so I've gone way off track already.
There is no off track. It's funny what you were saying that. One of the things that I often think is it's become unfashionable to use the word kind, as if kindness is no longer in fashion. It's almost the same as love. We just don't talk about these things anymore.
But kindness is crucial because it's all to do with your kin. It's to do with the people, the organisms you are part of. And we have this idea that we are so removed from nature. But actually, they are our kin. Every single thing out there, every plant, every twig, everything is all connected. We are all connected. I mean, I'm an ecologist by training. It's the inevitable consequence of studying ecology is the realization that every single part of this is connected. And so if we don't go and start, you know, raising a voice for those who don't have a voice, to use that cliche, if we don't start fighting, nobody else is going to fight for it. We have to.
Yeah.
I thought it was really interesting at the start of that clip where they're talking about the People's Walk for Wildlife and the passion and the love and going out, even if it's not the easiest thing to do, but being present and being together in a group, you know, of people physically doing something to make a difference and how that kindness, but also love and passion is so integral.
Yeah.
I love that quote, we will not fight to save what we do not love. It's like,
real deep.
Yeah.
Real deep on a Tuesday? Is it Tuesday?
Tis. And kindness.
Oh, that one's nice.
Yeah.
I think because I don't really... Everyone talks about being at one with nature.
Yeah.
That doesn't really mean anything to me. Does it mean anything to you?
City girl.
Well, no, I don't even know if it's that, but like I don't really see the difference between... Not that I don't see the difference, but like I like being in nature and like going on walks and but at the same time I'm not like it's not especially profound. Do you feel like you are at one with nature?
I think that since I've been more mindful about it, I've started to understand how not appreciating or respecting or looking after nature has an effect on me in a way that I might not see blatantly. So for example, the food I eat, the travelling I do, where I live, like I'm from a little seaside town. Do you know what I mean? So I've started to link it with how it would impact my life, if you see what I mean. But I know what you mean. Like it's not something that I would think about every single day.
Yeah,
for some people it's really integral in their lives.
Or that there's this like huge, like I'm like, sometimes I'm like, yeah, I definitely need to get into nature. And even though it's just a park, I'm in a park every single day because it's the route that I will always take to or from wherever I go. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I'm like, yeah, I really need to get into nature or like even just go and like immerse myself in water that isn't like a pool in a gym.
Yeah. Well, wildlife population has plunged 60% since 1970. So it's declining rapidly.
Wow.
Like really quickly. And I think because a lot of us feel that way, like, oh, it doesn't really affect me in my everyday life, it's an issue for the masses and it's an issue for everyone to be involved in. I wanted to play a clip from a really cool activist, so someone to inspire other people to get involved. And there's a girl called Maya Rose Craig. She's 16. She's a blog online. She's called Bird Girl. And she's been birding for 8 years with her parents. She started when she was a really young girl. But she does a lot of activism for the rights of animals and birds and the wildlife in her area, and she's been doing it since she was 8 years old.
Wow.
So I thought she would be a really cool person to listen to.
Yeah, totally.
I guess from a quite a young age I was aware that there wasn't really anyone else that looked like me that was also going out into nature, going out birding. But I didn't really think about why till I was a bit older, and then I did think about it and I was like, okay, this is a race thing. Like obviously there's a whole gender issue in the environmental sector as well, but for me it was quite a large race thing. So I was probably 13 when I was trying to think of things I could do to change it, because I didn't want it to be like that forever. I just thought it was very like sad, really, like really unfortunate that groups of people were missing out on going out into nature, because I just thought it was amazing and I wanted people to be able to share that experience.
Yeah, yeah.
So I at the time I was planning this little weekend camp for other kids that were into nature to come along to and have fun and go do some nature activities. So I decided that I wanted to get some inner city VME kids also coming on this camp to try and help them become engaged with nature. And
yeah, that's a fantastic thing to think at 13. You're saying like this little camp, but that's an amazing thing to do.
Thank you. I mean, it didn't feel very amazing.
It didn't feel like it at
all.
No.
No, not at all. It just, I don't know, it just seemed like a convenient, not easy, but like a convenient sort of thing that I could just add on to it, because I had all these kids that were going to come on the camp anyway, so I just thought, what's five more? And they came and it was amazing, because...
Well, this is something 30-year-olds think, not 13-year-olds.
I don't know, my brain's just a bit like that. I like I said before, I like doing things
a lot,
and I guess this is all slotted into that mindset quite nicely. But kind of, it's weird because that kind of wasn't the turning point for me. The actual camp was.
Okay.
When I saw these kids come along and they didn't want to be there at all. Like, they had no interest in stuff we were doing on the camp. All of them just like engaged with nature at some point and they had a good time. It was interesting for them. And like, almost more importantly, it was good for them. And I just thought it was so important. And then I ended up writing to these nature NGOs asking what they were doing, because I would, this like 13-year-old little girl could get some kids out and they could have a good time, then like they could be doing something too. And they're all really positive and they wrote back and they invited me up, and I couldn't go and visit them because I had school. So I said I wanted to bring them together so I could talk to them all as a group and get people that actually knew what they were talking about, not me, to talk to them. And my parents said, like, oh, that's called a conference, Maya. So I ended up organising this conference called Race Equality in Nature in Brazil. And when I say organising, like, obviously my parents have helped me massively. They've always been so, so supportive of everything I've done and helped me. No, I wasn't a 13-year-old organising a conference by herself.
I would have been slightly surprised if you'd done it all on your own. But, I mean, the fact is you took the initiative. I mean, how old were these kids you were bringing on the camp and at the conference?
The VME ones were... One was younger than me, but the rest were about 15.
That's an amazing... I keep saying amazing, but I mean, that's the impression I got, that they were a bit older than you. So you're this young girl saying to these kids, hey, come and see nature and I'll tell you why it's wonderful. It's great.
Thank you.
And you had to find ways to explain to their parents, or perhaps your mum explained to their parents how it would work and how it was going to be okay.
Yeah, definitely. That's the advantage that me and Black to Nature, that's like my organisation, have, is that I'm VME too, and it creates that link. And I know people within these communities who are trusted people. They're not outsiders coming in going like, oh, come on this camp. It's people that these parents trust saying this camp's really good, it's really safe. Maybe if needed, there'll be halal food. People are going to look after these kids. It's all going to be like good for them.
Yeah.
And having someone trusted tell them that makes a massive difference for these parents.
What an inspirational, cool woman.
Yeah, totally.
You can like Google her. She has it like her own web page. But as with all the other clips in the podcast, that clip's on Lush Player, so you can go and listen to Charlie's full interview with her and
learn great.
About her work. I think it's really cool as well. Like, it's seeing someone do that kind of influencer kind of weird thing, but she's doing it for like
birds.
Wildlife and birds and animal rights, which is really, really cool. It's a way that you can sort of use that for good. And amazing, imagine being that age and being that like knowing exactly what you want to do.
Yeah,
like that's really inspiring.
Imagine being this age and knowing what you want to do.
And when I was that age, I was like, I don't know.
I've got a mental block of thinking about myself as a 16-year-old. It just doesn't happen.
Because you were such a tragedy?
Yeah.
I was a tragedy when I was 16. I was just like, what is my life?
Yeah.
So great. Yeah, check her out. She's really, really cool. And she's got lots of cool work going on. So that wraps up our wildlife episode.
Maybe we should go to a park. No, because you said that was a cop-out. Maybe we should go to the Lake District.
Totally.
Now.
Right now.
Get your bags.
We're off on a holiday. Yeah, lots of beautiful articles as well on the Lush website about tips and tricks as well for recycling and all those kinds of things. All those little things that you can do from home that have an effect down the line somewhere to our wildlife and environment.
And actually just one last thing to say as well, mm-hmm. despite saying how I feel about, I just don't get, I suppose I think that when anyone says like go into nature, I think that they turn into some like yogi and like get really namaste, and I'm always like, don't really get that, but I do get a nice feeling. But I think something you said before, it made me think about it, is like you don't realize, even though you're maybe not conscious, if you're having a negative effect on the world, it's probably affecting you subconsciously somewhere.
Yeah. And I
so
think
maybe just be kind.
Be kind, yeah. And I think every time we step outside or do anything, what? We have a negative effect on the world, which is really depressing. But it's true, you know, it's so true. And but at the weekend I was at Pride in Belfast and it was amazing. I had a great time, saw loads of cool people. I was walking around and the streets were covered in rubbish and litter and it was disgusting. Even like small, like tiny, tiny grass areas in the middle of the city. And we don't, you people walk past that, don't think about it. So that rubbish all gets trampled over, which then gets embedded into the grass, which then kills whatever bugs or insects are living in that tiny, tiny patch of grass. It's a whole ecosystem that we just don't think about because we're so selfish.
Yeah.
So it's about being mindful of the tiny, tiny, tiny things that do have an impact, because the more those build over time, then we have the repercussions that we have at the minute of climate change. Thank you for listening to the Lush Podcast with me, Nilla Davies, and my phenomenal co-host, Olivia Graham. Today's episode was edited by Elise McKenna with music by The Fresh Handmade Collective. For more information on today's episode, check out the links in the description below. If you like what you've heard today, don't forget to subscribe. And if you'd like to hear more podcasts by Lush, you can download the free Lush Player app, available for both Apple and Android.